Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week we take a deep dive into the tech behemoths, Facebook, Google, Apple, Microsoft and Amazon, also known as the FANG stocks, although over time Microsoft has seemingly ousted Netflix for a position in the group. The term was coined by Jim Cramer, the television host of CNBC's Mad Money in 2013, who praised these companies for being totally dominant in their markets. In addition to being widely known among consumers, the six FANG stocks are amongst the largest companies in the world, with a combined market capitalization of nearly $9 trillion and make up over a quarter of the S&P 500 index, which is a heavy weighting considering that there are 500 companies in the overall list. FANG stocks have historically outperformed the S&P 500 index. Since the market bottom in March of 2009, the worst performing FANG stock, Alphabet, which is Google, has returned more than double the index average. There is no question that investment in these companies has shown fantastic returns over the last decade or so. So the question remains, will it continue? Whilst almost in the too big to fail camp of corporations, there are a number of headwinds that might unseat them from their dominance in the market. Today, we share our take on these titans of technology, including looking at the various investment management methods like quality, value, and growth, and how they'll perform, especially when considering inflation. We'll then review the impacts of industry environments and where structural changes may have real meaning to the future of these companies. Here to share his thoughts on why the rising tech behemoths are important to consider and where they sit in our portfolios, we have our head of investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And just a quick reminder before we get started, and if you haven't already, to subscribe and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch. And of course, you can always follow us on your preferred podcast platform. We also ask if you'd like to take a moment now to click like on the video to help our show grow. And of course, for all of those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat to have them answered along the way. Fantastic. So let's get into it. We've got our agenda for today. And so, as I mentioned there, we're going to be having a look at the quality, value and growth side of the investment management techniques. And of course, inflation. We'll then be looking through some structural changes, some valuations, and how to actually value these, I think, Damien, which will be quite fascinating because no one seems to know. It'll be great to hear your thoughts. And then, of course, a potential growth crash as well, and how the impact that may impact these megalith stocks in the tech space. So, excellent. Let's jump into it.
Yeah, so I think that the main reason wanting to deal with these is we've been speaking a lot about inflation recently, and still the biggest theme we need to look at. We also need to be a bit worried about whether we'll get a bit of a slump in growth later on this year in terms of as the inventory supercycle rolls over. We spoke last week and the week before a lot about the issues in terms of Chinese growth, and so they're the things sort of watching. And one of the asset classes we've put a lot of our funds into is what we call quality growth, which is the part of the market. So there's sort of what you call we call it junk growth, but other people will call it the higher risk end of the growth market, and that's sort of been performing really well that performed quite well last year, and in recent months that's been performing well. That performed well last year as we saw the interest rates just keep ratcheting lower, and not a lot of growth elsewhere. And so that's sort of one area you'd expect to see grow quite strongly if what we're saying is right in terms of inflation. And then the other part, this quality end, the ones that do have real earnings and real cash flows and other things underlying them, which helps sort of support the valuations, that's where we've sort of been putting a decent chunk of our money. And so we thought we'd focus a bit on that this time around, just to sort of give you an idea of what the of why and what they look like. What are those investments? How do they perform? And so I wanted to talk sort of big picture about that quality versus growth sort of angles as to the first step as to why you're doing this. And then the second step is then saying, well, once you've decided that's what you're doing, what are the stocks within the sector? What do they look like? And what type of earnings are we seeing, and earnings growth are we seeing from these companies? So I'll take one step back again to sort of preface this by this whole quality versus value argument. And so I've got a chart up there just sort of showing the quality versus value lines. And so we rank in the way we invest is we'll rank every stock on that sort of vertical axis by how cheaper or how expensive it is, with the cheapest ones down the bottom. That's on the horizontal axis, and then on the vertical axis, we rank everything as to whether it's good quality or poor quality, with the best quality at the bottom. And we try and buy things sort of under that curve, with the view that they're the stocks that over time are tend to give you good upside performance, but a decent amount of downside protection as well, in terms of the best quality stocks are the ones that don't actually go poorly when you do get downturns. Or they go, yeah, they don't fall as far. Whereas if you're trying to invest in something like some of the really high growth stuff, like your Teslas and things like that, yep, they're the ones that are going to ride up the most. But then when things crash, they'll crash more than everyone else as well. And so you get the wildest ride on those ones.
Yeah, sure. And just so everybody knows, this chart that you've put together, which is obviously our own research analysis, and is actually available for any one of our investors to view on an individual basis with all of it. So this is a snapshot from basically the client portal, the dashboard.
Yeah, that's right. We put these together on all the stocks we're doing, just so people can see why we're buying it. Because for us, it's a matter of really knowing about why you're buying stocks within it. So you can see on this, if we're buying higher quality stocks like Apple, we're actually happy to buy them if they're a little bit expensive. And yep, hold them at that level. So the idea is that you're trying to buy your high quality stocks and hang with them, because they're the ones that are going to keep churning out that growth and keep getting those good returns. Whereas if you're buying things that are more average quality, as they then start getting more expensive, it's a question to roll out of those and into something else. So as a good example, earlier on this year, we as part of that whole valuation rotation, we bought a number of cement manufacturers. They sort of rose sort of 25% ish over that period, and then it was time to roll out of those, because they were just cement manufacturers. Sort of by definition are pretty low tech. There's not a lot of barriers to entry, and they tend to trade on quite low multiples. So if you can buy them at low multiples and sell them at average multiples, then you're sort of happy with that. Whereas the ones the higher quality stocks sort of just keep on getting getting good returns on equity and reinvesting their money and getting good returns on that reinvestment, they're the ones you sort of want to hold, and you're prepared for them to go up and down, and you'll just sort of stick with that for over the long term.
Yeah, sure. Yep. No, great explanation.
Okay, so that's sort of the big picture of it. Now we've also gone a lot. So on the next slide, we're just talking about this inventory super cycle, and we've gone a lot into detail in prior weeks as well, that we've seen in what we've talked about is that it's looking to roll over, and we're starting to see a few signs of that. There might just be it might be head fakes still, but you know, one of these here, there's a manufacturing PMI, and its backlog of orders is pretty clearly rolled over. Most of the price measures on these types of surveys are starting to roll over as well. We've been using the lumber market is a good example where
I was going to say, yeah, timber in the US is a great one. Yep.
Yeah. So timber's gone up, four times in price, from sort of $400 to sort of hit $1,700 a ton for a bit there. And then it's fallen back sort of down to 1,000. So it's sort of down sort of 40% off its highs, still well above where it started. But it does seem to be that our thesis, this is an inventory super cycle, and there's just that real squeeze as everyone's trying to force everyone's trying to buy the same stuff all at the same time, and with stimulus coming behind it and ships getting stuck in the Suez Canal and just the whole manufacturing part, people not being able to travel, it sort of all sort of pushed this. And you can see on the other chart we've got there is this idea that retail sales are really pushed higher. But because people didn't have anything else to do with their money. You couldn't travel. Services were limited. You know, things like recreation, you couldn't. You're limited in what you can do, and so people took the money and spent it on what they could, which was goods. And we think that will revert is our view. And so I guess that's in mind as we're looking at where we go to. So the stocks that have performed really well over the last few months, things like your manufacturing stocks, your cyclicals, and those ones, it's what we're saying is it's time to rotate out of those for these reasons, and we expect these to continue, and then you'll see some that quality growth. The stocks that performed well last year, we're expecting to be the same types of stocks that will perform well again this year.
Okay, yeah, great.
So,
I was just going to say, so we're jumping across to the quality value growth, are we now, just to run through those? It might pay just to help those that haven't been following us all the way through to cover off a little bit on those. But values had quite an interesting little period in the sun recently, perhaps, to get us started, Damien.
Absolutely, values performed really well. So you know, since the vaccines came out, so since November last year, it's been on a very good run. We sort of took quite a lot of value positions within our portfolios, with a view that inflation would spike higher and there was this whole inflation scare. If you're expecting that inflation is real and it's going to be, you know, inflation's going to be bad over the next few years, then the value trade isn't over. Like it's time to be back in and well, it's time to stay in, I guess, and keep with it. Our view is that you've got to, it's largely temporary. There will be a reversion higher in terms of inflation, 3 or 4 years away. But it's a for the moment we think the tide's headed in the opposite direction, and a few of our prior podcasts and blog posts have sort of cover off, I guess, enough in that. But it's worth noting that each of these are different bets that you're taking. So or value in particular is a different bet to most other things. So value is a bet on mean reversion. So most other investment strategies are bets on non-mean reversion. So if I'm buying high quality stocks, it's a bet that they're going to continue to be high quality. If I'm buying growth stocks that are growing, I'm betting they're going to keep growing. Value is actually the opposite. It's I've bought a stock that is cheap and I'm expecting it to get back to expensive, or vice versa, it's expensive and come back to cheap. And they behave very differently. And what tends to happen is that value is a strategy that doesn't work for a long time, and then all of a sudden it works for a little while and works really well for a little while. And so we've had a little bit of performance. Yeah, traditionally, if you get a flip back to value, it would go much, much longer. So if this inflation was all real, or if it is real and continues, then value, you know, can go considerably higher from here. Our take though is it's not. And so sorry. Yep.
No, I was just gonna say, just on that, just sort of with the value piece. So practically, it's a company that is beaten down in price for whatever reason. It's got headwinds. It's, you know, it's pretty evident, and it gets to a point where the market overreaches or oversells to put it on the radar of a value investor, someone who's, you know, just wants to buy something that's cheap. Does that then mean that, you know, when you say the value, you know, as we mentioned, you know, it does get its day in the sun occasionally. Is that just a simple mechanism that people have run out of things to buy, so they end up buying value?
Okay. So it's a mix of two things. That's the case sometimes. The other thing is that what you find with value stocks is they are very cheap and priced for not a lot of growth, and they will go through periods of the cycle where they will get the growth. So your typical cement manufacturer, and people are sort of trading them on, say, you know, 8 or 9 times their earnings, and with just not expecting much growth, and sort of grinds out a few percent here and a few percent there every year, and then you go through a cyclical upturn, and next thing you know, the company's got 10-15% growth for a year or two, and so you get this kick up in earnings, it gets you sort of 10 or 15%, and then people look at the valuation and go, well, this company's just done 15% over 2 years and it's only trading on 8 times. Maybe it should be trading on 12 times earnings rather than 8 times earnings. And so there's a 50% increase in the uplift in the valuation as well at the same time. And so it's that sort of mechanism of both the re-rating in terms of the value and It typically comes as the growth is starting to take off as well.
Okay.
So it's sort of like that beginning of cycle. It's a very beginning of cycle play in terms of what you're looking for in terms of value.
Lovely. But, all right. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Yeah. Yep. And then the biggest issue with growth stocks, and because sort of that they're the ones that sound the most exciting for everyone, is like, well, you know, if I've got a choice between what I'm going to buy, let me go and buy growth, because that'll just keep, you know, I want something that's going to grow in terms of its share price. The biggest issue is always buying at the right price, because it's very easy to find growth stocks that are just overpriced. And so they're priced for success already. So it's a bit like your horse racing. You know, if you, you know, yes, you want the fastest horse, absolutely. But if you're, if it means you're getting odds, you know, the favorite, not everyone bets on the favorite, because the odds are so low, is that, you know, every now and again, the favorite won't win. And
it's not worth the risk. Yeah,
exactly. And you, yeah, your upside versus downside just isn't worth it. And so that's where growth is often that's the real key issue for growth. And you find with a lot of stocks, especially now, they are priced for, you know, incredible success, and it just means that if they're merely, you know, extremely successful, they're not incredibly successful, then the stock will fall, because it's just priced overpriced.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say Google and Facebook. So I'm going to start with the advertising guys as well. Is the big issue for these guys? They've got a few big issues coming up. The first is regulatory issues. So they are being looked at from, you know, in a range of different areas. The second part is that advertising spending itself is actually very, very cyclical. So advertising is one of those things that companies are, when things get tough, companies are prepared to pull that quite quickly, and vice versa, put it on. And so if you are looking at a lot of manufacturing companies, if this is an inventory super cycle that will fade, then you might see a little bit of weakness on the advertising spending, especially if people are sort of switching from say goods to more services and more travel and things like that.
Yep.
But there's on the positive side for these guys, there's this online shift which is extremely structural, and that's the one I've put up a chart on the right there, just sort of showing some of the spend for the advertising spend on mobile versus TVs and PCs, and there's just this inexorable trend that every year more and more money goes from traditional advertisers like your TV stations and your newspapers and your radio, and shifts online onto podcasts, onto Google mobile search, mobile, yep. If anything, that trend has been amplified by coronavirus and this whole work from home and structural change to what people are doing.
Almost the Netflix effect, isn't it? So, you know, I can't even remember the last time I watched free to wear television with commercials and all the rest of it. So it's one of those things that you migrate across eventually.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, if you're unsure about that yourself, and especially a lot of older investors sort of find that hard to believe, you know, just ask some of your grandkids or nephews or nieces, what the last show they watched on free-to-air TV was. And most of them will have to ask you for what a definition of free-to-air TV actually is. And how does it relate to YouTube or TikTok?
Our house doesn't even have a TV antenna. It's sort of gone full across to the online world. Yeah, very good.
Absolutely. I think there's that shift. So that doesn't mean though that you have to buy these stocks, because again, as I spoke, and I want to keep emphasizing that it is very much this issue of price versus what you're getting. And the other factor as well is that they've got this thing happening with, there's some large privacy issues that are going on at the moment, that is going to reduce the amount of information that advertisers have on customers. My take is that look, it's going to make an issue. It is a bit of an issue for them, but a bigger issue is it's affecting pretty much all the players within the industry. And so there's not a lot of it's not an online versus offline, because the reality is the offline data, you have very, very, very poor data offline anyway. So you're going to have slightly less data about customers online, but you still have way more data on online about what customers are doing. So if you're a if you're on Facebook, for example, and you want to advertise four-wheel drives, you can find people who like camping and fishing and you know, things like that, and hit those guys up from what you know about them from their Facebook profile. What you won't be able to do is see that they've actually been to these camping and fishing sites all around the rest of the internet and then have come back to Facebook, you know, as part of that. So well, you still know those things.
Yeah. And it's sort of like the, well, I guess in the offline world, as you say, you don't know who's picking up your newspaper or, you know, reading your magazine. And the only way to get it's often very expensive. It's those phone call survey sort of things that, you know, that people can do that were sort of, I think, a bit more prevalent in the past, but these days it's so easy to get the online metrics. But, you might as well just go down that path.
Oh, absolutely. But regardless of whether you've got the information or not, you still can't say, you still can't turn around to your newspaper and say, look, I'd like a full paid ad for a Jeep, but can you only put that in the editions that go to people who might buy these overs, camping and fishing, but you can send somebody else's ad to the other one. You just can't do it. Whereas online you can do that. You will have less information going forward on it, but you've still got a lot of information.
What do you mean by that? Why we have less information going forward in your mind?
So basically Apple's putting through some privacy changes within so you'll have to opt in to a lot of the tracking.
Okay.
And so what Facebook does at the moment is it lets sites put Facebook pixels on their site. And so what it means is that Facebook doesn't only know what you've been up to on Facebook, it also knows what you've been up to on other websites.
Yep.
And which sites you've been to. So, and similar with Google as well. Yeah. So they can actually go that part of, if you might be a Facebook user who hasn't joined a camping and fishing group, but because they've seen you've been to the BCF website and you go and check the conditions and things like that, they can actually work out, oh, okay, we're going to apply that to Tim and show him these ads.
Yeah.
But
sure.
The reality is most of the people who are on these ones already have, you know, pictures of themselves going forward driving, or they've got, that joined a four-wheel driving group or a fishing group or whatever it is. And so, you know, as a maker of say a Jeep, you can still get that. You can still get that for most of the customers.
I was just going to say just quickly on that. So we've sort of, it's pretty widely known that these companies are getting so big. There's regulatory headwinds, you know, they are actually getting so big. They need to be, controlled. So is this an example of perhaps self-regulation in the privacy space to help alleviate those regulatory concerns?
Yeah, or competitive maybe as well in terms of Apple versus others. So I guess it's if you can. I think Apple's probably doing it for the right reason, but you know, the fact that it's affecting some of its competitors probably isn't a
bad thing.
It's an additional benefit. For it,
okay, yeah, sure, all right,
but yeah, they certainly do have regulatory issues in terms of the amount of dominance they've got, and all these ones as well. They work very much on this whole idea of the network effect, and you'll see that out there a lot for all these. Is that Facebook's value is largely that so many people have got Facebook, and because if nobody had it, it wouldn't matter if its system was 10 times better than everyone else's, if everyone else is on a different website. And so, having that network effect that you can go on there and you know your friends are on there and things like that. And the other thing to very much remember with Facebook as well in this is that it's not just Facebook. Facebook also owns a number of other platforms that are highly used by younger generation. So Facebook's very good for sort of your 40-year-olds and 30 to 50s.
It's a great tool for being reminded of when people's birthdays are for mine, but that's about the limit of its for me. But it's probably worth it on that alone.
Lots of other people use it, but you know, there's the Snapchats and things like that are very much used by younger generations. And so, Instagram. So Instagram is a Facebook property as well. And so, they do have that sort of some diversification in terms of the different groups that they're approaching.
Yeah.
So in valuation though, that's probably, oh, sorry. So the first one is, I've got a, just growth, just sort of showing that, you know, these guys just keep journeying. The top one's Google of this in terms of earnings forecast, and the bottom one's Facebook. But yeah, their earnings just sort of keep going up year after year after year. And you can see that the 2023 numbers are considerably above where we are now. They do get, I've got the numbers up here where, you know, this is the forecast numbers for Facebook on a rolling 12-month basis is basically for 35% growth for next year for sales and 18% for the year after. And yeah, those types of growth numbers are pretty incredible. You just don't get that type of growth elsewhere unless you sort of especially not organic growth. You know, they're getting quite huge growth rates, and they're not horrendously expensive. So yeah, this Facebook here, and it's sort of trading on if you look at the second 12 months earnings, it's trading on about 20 times, a bit above, almost 21 times second year's earnings. So you know, it's still a little bit expensive, but it's nowhere near as expensive as most of its peers, and certainly relative to its own history, you haven't been able to pick up, you know, Facebook, for example, this cheaply for pretty much forever. It's relative to where it's been trading at in the past. Now, you know, will there be major regulatory changes? Possibly. I think the big picture, in the big picture sense, I think taxation is probably the biggest one coming for these guys at the moment. You might see some more regulation. Watching Europe, that's probably the key one. I think if you get a Republicans back in power, they'll probably be looking for some regulation as a bit of payback. But I think for the moment,
Only offshoring of profits and those sort of things.
Yeah, well, that's the offshoring of profits. This is this global tax rate that has been, you know, actively spoken about, and actively the G7 recently met and put forward some proposals. And so I'd say that put that on the likely case, is that you will see some sort of global tax rate. Taking it from there. The other thing for Google to remember as well is Google, so Facebook, you know, it's to me, it's very much a structural play in terms of expecting that offline revenue will keep shifting online, and then you will be facing some headwinds, but that's just a tide that's coming in and you know, with a reasonable valuation structural reason to be wanting to buy sort of these quality growth stocks. You know, Facebook fits into one of the categories that we quite like. Google is very similar. It's not quite as cheap versus its history, but it is still relatively cheap versus its history. I think the other thing you'll find is Google does have some other businesses. I mean, it's mostly search, but certainly it's YouTube is a very interesting competitor to, or as people are shifting more video online, you're sort of seeing benefits from there. And they also have a lot of this web hosting that we'll talk about a little bit more for Microsoft and for Amazon in particular. But that's a very good business. So it's one of these businesses that's very much win-win-win. You get to take somebody who might have been doing processing locally on their own machines and spending, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars on the database power and the processing power, and you can turn around to that person and reduce their costs by, you know, 70-80% and still be making a 50% margin on the whole thing. And so you just see some great profitability from that area. And then they've got a few moonshots.
Well, it has a lot of efficiency, doesn't it? Because you get really high tech hardware that a business might need every now and then, and then you basically can then farm it out across the world and make sure it's used at 100% capacity. And you know, obviously everyone gets a share of the profit, or the discount rather. So
And the whole coronavirus shutdown has supercharged that process, because I think what was happening was a lot of companies were trialing it and testing it out online, or even running dual systems where they were like, okay, we've got our internal systems and we've got this cloud-based system. We're trying to run them both. And then the coronavirus hit and all of a sudden your workers couldn't turn up to your work. And I was like, well, why have we got this one internally as well? And what's the relative costs? And the growth rates have been incredible in those industries. So Amazon's the biggest one in that area. and it is just making up. It's gone from being an afterthought to pretty much the key revenue driver and the key profit driver within Amazon. Like it's it is significantly.
Do you think there's do you think it'll be an opportunity for them to carve it out and give it its own entity?
Possibly. I think that they've spoken about it a few times, and there's positives and negatives from it. I think for the moment it's staying internally, but if it was separated out, it would be a big positive for Amazon. One of the problems for Amazon, we run into that issue within our own fund. So let me skip forward to the Amazon, skip Microsoft for the moment, and jump to Amazon. One of the things within our portfolios we find is that Amazon's a very expensive stock from a from just a price perspective. Not forget the valuation of it. Its share price is like $3,000 or $4,000 in Aussie terms. I'd have to check the conversion rate is, but it means that when you try to fit it within for some of our clients have smaller portfolios, it's quite hard to fit it within the portfolio because you either need to, and you can't sort of, I'd like to have, 12%, or I'd like to have say 5% of my portfolio in that. And you're like, well, no, you can't because the way the share price is running, you can either have 8% or 4%.
Of course. You
have a choice about the in-betweens. Yep. But Amazon's very interesting in that it's sort of, so first of all, this, It's the biggest in the in that data service area, and that's where most of its profit growth has come from. I've just got to get some of its earnings growth numbers up here, so you can see that they're sort of again pretty incredible in terms of so last year had this massive growth where 40% growth because of a lot of people switching to online, but it looks like as if next year is still going to be 30% growth, and the year after that's going to be this sales growth is going to be 17%. So it's less like some of the other ones where it's like everyone switched to, everyone needed to buy lots of toilet paper. So toilet paper sales went blasted up, but then they're coming back down again because people are still only using so much toilet paper. And so, they just won't buy as much the next year. It does seem as if the structural change and the structural shift for Amazon is real, and more and more people who have started shopping online and are continuing that trend and increasing.
Okay.
So the way to think about Amazon is very much that the way I look at the business anyway is that you sort of got you're buying three parts. You're buying this incredible growth engine in this AWS or Amazon Web Services, which is which I spoke about a little bit, but it's the least seen part of the Amazon business, but it's got the most profit growth and is the most profitable in its own right.
Okay.
You have you have Amazon US, which is profitable, good business. Its margins tend to be quite low relative to other retailers. And there's this whole question about will one day they increase their margins and all of a sudden make a lot more money from it? Maybe that'll happen, but it's certainly within its own right, it's growing quite strongly and sits quite well. And then it's international business, which tends to be tends to not look as good and has been lost making and certainly various parts of it have lost money within that international business because it just doesn't have that same reach and the same network effect you see a little bit in the US where so many people are using it. Yep. So if you break it out in that way and look at it and said, if you start saying, well, let me treat the international business as worthless and let me look at the other two, you actually end up with Amazon looking a lot better on that basis. The other thing is because of this incredible growth in profits we've seen, particularly from the AWS division, you're actually at the stage now where Amazon has always looked horrendously expensive from most traditional metrics because it's often had these large loss-making divisions. When you look at it now, it still looks expensive. It's sort of I'll put some of the charts where we show it sort of sits at the 75th percentile, so to speak, or closer to the 80th on some of the versus market ones. And so it's not particularly cheap on those metrics. But if you look at it versus its own history, it's basically it's as cheap as it's ever been versus its own history. It's
amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's the part where. So for Amazon, the structural growth drivers I think are still there. the valuation relative to its own history. The question is, will it ever get back to trading on 100 time earnings and things like that? It probably won't. It probably is going to keep, we'll keep the profits will keep flowing and gradually it'll come up on a more reasonable multiple. So it's still a little bit on the expensive side, but they're certainly a lot more attractive than you would have said from a fundamental perspective at other times. And I can certainly see where the fundamental growth drivers are coming from for it.
Okay, great.
Let's jump back to Microsoft because that sort of sits in that same bucket. So they're another one really big on this whole online processing. And so
I was just going to say, yeah, because Microsoft has often been a bit of a fallow stock, hasn't it, in reflection to some of the other, more exciting, racier tech names in the past, not now, but they've certainly resurged themselves back into one of the winning tech plays, haven't they? And a lot of that has been to do with a move into the AWS, I guess, space a little bit.
Yep. News online and the whole software as a service, there was very much they've been a quietly an exceptional performer in the last sort of 5 years. Is that all the excitement and the headlines probably go to other ones, but Microsoft has just been plowing ahead from and profitability wise just going from strength to strength in terms of those. So it's not particularly cheap, certainly versus its own history as well. It's a little bit expensive versus its own history. It's about average versus its industry, maybe a little bit cheaper than average. But it's extremely high quality. They're benefiting very much for that shift online, whether it be within their own sort of Azure services we spoke about, or whether it's just people shifting to using more of the Microsoft OneDrives and things like that, as we see the rise in the hacking and the that sort of more focus on that. On the security angle, it's just that the idea of having backups and other people are in, have got those systems and online that, multiple versions of it, sort of across multiple different regions, and that if you go to an AWS or a Microsoft or a Google, they do have some of the best security experts out there. So nothing's unhackable, but the chance of a the chance of those guys getting hacked is not that it's impossible, but it's a lower probability than your own system. If somebody decides to target you as a company, then knowing that you've shut all the holes versus saying, well, we're relying on Microsoft or Amazon or something like that to be doing all those things for us is it's a bit chalk and cheese, especially for smaller companies.
Yeah, for mine as well. Obviously, the move that Microsoft have made to this annual billing. In the past, you used to buy a bit of Microsoft software, which is not generally quite good, and obviously, it's renowned in the industry. And then that was it; that was all you paid. And so, if you could use it for 10 years, it did quite well out of it. And now it seems like everything's subscription based, so just probably helping the recurring revenue side of their business globally.
Absolutely, I suspect it probably helps as well a lot in terms of this, the quality as well that you're getting out of them. In that there's not a rush to say we have to push through a new product, because if we don't push through a new product, we're not getting paid.
Yeah,
it's now more about saying, okay, we've got our product. We actually just want this product to be really, to be really solid and work. And you can push updates out to these things incrementally over time, rather than sort of having to, come out with a brand new box that we could sell in a thing and convince everyone you've got to go out and buy this new box by adding all these new features. And some of the features might not quite be ready. Whereas now you can, I think there's certainly benefits for them on those. So it's still, I think it's certainly looked upon as the less exciting of all the above, but from a quality perspective and the growth is not dissimilar to what you're seeing from the others. We're certainly still quite keen on Microsoft as part of those. The last part is probably the part where I've got some question marks. Look, Apple's a very big stock, and we do have it within our portfolio because there's a number of positives and a number of negatives. The thing to remember with Apple is you do have a number of different things, but in reality you have an iPhone. Like there's a lot of there's lots of other bits to it, but if they're not selling phones, then they're not being successful.
A little bit on this new chip that they've generated, obviously, to sort of push Intel out of their PC side of things. And I think I read something the other day where it's actually headed into the phone systems as well, or might be already.
Yeah, it already is. Yeah, the new Apple chip is quite is very much market leading, and there's an opportunity for them here to say. So I guess the question is, do they leave it in there in all their own equipment and just look to try and pick up extra market share, or do they actually start trying to sell it out and do some third party sales for? So basically, the chip advantages really is around. What they've done is they've got lower cost specialist chips and lower specs specialist chips, with the idea of saying in the past, you'd get an Intel chip and it would try and do everything for you, and you just keep getting bigger chip and a bigger chip and a bigger, more memory, more everything, and you'd hope and they try and be optimized because they say, okay, we want to be able to do higher processing, but we don't want to suck the battery out of your phone or whatever, so we'll try and or your laptop, and so we'll try and keep the power limits. Whereas Apple's basically taken a different turn, and what they've managed to do is get these chips working where they're like, okay, we have one chip, and its job is to provide background working for your phone at really, really low power. That's all it does. And then we've got another one that's really good at image processing. And that's all it does, is if you want to take a photo and you want to crop it or do whatever, it's the chip that's doing it. And it's really good at doing that. But if you ask it to do some maths or something, or run an Excel spreadsheet or do something like that, it's actually not going to be very good at it. But that's okay, because we've got another cheap chip sitting over there that's going to do those. And so what they've done is, and it's the meshing together of those that's quite successful. And it's very much going from the old system of chips where an Intel or an AMD would design a chip that's just a very generalist chip, but it wouldn't be particularly good at anything, but particularly good at any one thing, but very good at a bunch of it, and that whole meshing. And so there's an opportunity there. Be interesting to see how much they take advantage of it, but it's certainly some upside. The flip side is we've got people have been buying products because they haven't been able to buy services, and an Apple phone is a product. Yep. And so as people get back out and start traveling more, as they get back out and start spending more on recreation or spending more at the gym or, restaurants and haircuts and things like that, will the sales of Apple dip away? Quite potentially. There's also the fact that, for individuals, phones are lasting longer and longer. So the average life per phone is extending every year. That's on the negative side. Back on the positive side, Apple is getting more, it's being a bit more capital efficient than what it used to be, and starting to do more buybacks. There's some positivities on that front. So, Apple net is a sort of, for me, it's the least exciting of them, and so it's more of a, in terms of an Apple investment, is more of a view that, look, if this whole, or it's a double-sided, if this whole thing's going to keep rising, and is a push into tech, is that you'll probably get a little bit of a rising tide, there is a little bit as well of the I guess a diversification benefit in terms of it is quite different to the other ones we've shown above, in terms of what it's chasing. So if there is a reversion back to products over services, or lockdowns extend for longer and things like that, then maybe there's a bit more safety within those. There's one more negative on Apple as well. There's also other political things at play. Obviously, there's a lot of trade tensions between China and the US some real issues in terms of politically. The other stocks I spoke about, are largely that's not an issue for them. Google and Facebook aren't in China, and they're sort of, that was their issue 10 years ago, where as they were leaving China because they wouldn't do what the government wanted them to. Whereas Apple still has that whole China issue sort of yet to come.
We'll have to wait and see. A couple of questions have come in, if you like, before we move over to the crash side, the growth crash scenario, just on some stocks. If you want to, we could maybe work through those now, Damien. So from Candy Flip Records, thank you. Often asking some questions, and we appreciate those. And anybody else, just feel free to pop in some questions in the chat as well, of course. How much growth has Facebook realistically got left in it now?
I think he's actually said question answered a little bit lower,
That's right. Yeah.
But you're right in terms of there is that issue about where can you get the youth on, and I think Facebook in particular has got other options and seems to be very happy to take that. I think there's a for me there's a part about kids don't want to be on Facebook because that's where their parents are, and the next generation's on Snapchat or Instagram, and I think there'll be a level of people who are like, there'll be maybe your kids, Tim. My kids are on Instagram, but your kids will be like, no, those older kids are on there. We're on some other new product.
The new thing. Yep.
And I think it looks as if Facebook anyway is sort of content to say, well, we'll just keep snapping those up, putting them into the ecosystem and driving revenue through them. So
across the board. Okay.
There are issues with growth, but I think for the large part, that structural shift is the big one for me. If you are an advertiser who's decided that you want to move another 2-3% of your offline advertising online, where are you going to put it? And you really don't have too many choices. You've got your Facebook group with Instagram and Facebook. You've got your Google suite of YouTube and those ones. I guess you can go to TikTok, but you really start to get down on the you go to Bing, I suppose. Your choices drop off quite quickly.
Okay, very good. There was one here. I think we sort of might have covered off on it again. We're being very thorough. We're getting ahead of our own questions here. But it was a good point on Amazon being so high. Do you see them doing a stock split to assist the barrier of entry, targeting Robin Hood crowd, etc.?
Yeah. Oh, look, I think it'd be a good idea. I don't know.
it seems that, obviously we've been running for, 4 years, and that was a big problem for us in the early days with our direct international exposure was, if you wanted a 1% holding, and the company was a couple of $1,000, you needed $200,000 just to get, to get one share. And it does appear like sort of over the journey, though, that the bigger companies have been a bit more amenable to stock splitting.
Apple's done two since we've in the last 4 years, and they're certainly they'll happen. Amazon's just one of those ones that hasn't yet. So
yeah, right. Yeah, interesting. Wonder if they're holding off because of the AWS carve out. Who knows? All right. Cool. Growth crash.
So this is the part where, I just want to take us back. So I've spoken initially about saying we think the inflation scare is a scare, it's not real. And so therefore growth stocks have got some attractiveness at this point in the cycle over growth over value. And this is why we've tried to pick ones that have got quality, which is why we've focused on the FANGs. The next steps is then saying, okay, what are the big risks? And your big risk at the moment is that you'll have a China slowing quite rapidly, which looks to be happening. Will they stamp? They might stamp back on the accelerator, and this will all be a moot point. But at the moment, they're very much trying to fix their economy and reduce the leverage that's in the economy. If it is an inventory cycle, it all rolls over, and you start seeing some growth drop off. And the third part is stimulus. I'll use the US, but it is similar in most other countries. It was sort of front loaded as being pushed out to consumers. There's some other stimulus coming through in terms of infrastructure stimulus, especially in the US. That stuff doesn't get turned on overnight, and it hasn't even passed through the Senate yet for the large part. And so that means there's sort of a bit of a growth hole that pops up as you start to cycle those, government spending. Once you start, when you spend $1 billion and next year you only spend $900 million and then everyone's like, well, you're still spending $900 million. It's like, well, yeah, but it's 10% lower than what it was the year before. And our whole world's all about growth and things like that. And so that's where you could see this growth crash later on this year. And that's one of the key risks we're monitoring as to whether that happens. So the question is, if you jump from your value stocks into these stocks, what happens if you hit that growth crash? Look, if you hit a growth crash, everything's coming down. Like I'm not going to turn around and say yes, these things are going to last through it. They're going to sink. Defensives are going to be a better play, which is why within our portfolio we're trying to load up for both. We're sort of what's called a barbell strategy. We're saying, well, let's take some high risk ones, let's take some low risk ones, and so we're making sure we can take part of some of that growth, but we're not completely exposed. So you do want to have something in your portfolio that's going to protect you if you get that. They're probably not exposed to the key areas. Like if you did see a bit of a growth slump, it's probably more likely to be in things like manufacturing. And some of those cyclical growth areas of the market. There'll be a bit in advertising, but the flip side is, you know, you've still got that rising tide that I spoke about. You know, net, they're not going to be fantastic performers. They're going to be better than the value stocks still. It's your big risk. You're saying, you know, you don't want to go, load everything you've got into these stocks and there's no downside. It's there's a reasonable chance that if you get a Goldilocks economy for the next little while where growth doesn't fall far enough, interest rates stay low, then this is where you want to be. Yep. But the risk is if they fall further, you're not going to want any equities, but all equities are going to fall, but the defensive equities are going to be a better position if you do really get some significant growth concerns.
Yeah, sure. So actually just on that for the audience, so give us some examples of the defensive area, or where you call defensive, I guess, in the stock market.
Yeah, so the key ones are usually utilities, telecommunications, and REITs. So real estate investment trusts.
Yep.
Typically are the most defensive ones, because they tend to have stable earnings and so you have those downturns and their earnings don't really change much. Having said that, within those, the utilities, you need to be careful at the moment. There's a lot happening with climate change and a lot of structural change within the industry. So it's not quite the same as what it might have been 20 years ago, where you're like, right, there's a downturn coming, let me pile my stuff into that.
Yep.
The REITs is one area where, you know, we're still not quite sure what's happening with CBD properties. Are we going to have this structural shift and people work from home? Is the property worth what it used to be? Should we just be pricing it on all people turning it back into apartments, it is?
Good point.
And so, there's certainly some issues in the whole REIT sector. A lot of the places we've been trying to play in that area are ones like the public storage, which is a storage REIT for people have bought a whole lot of manufactured goods and they're going to need somewhere to put them.
Spend a bit too much time on Amazon over the lockdown period.
That's right. So we've taken those ones. The other one we're quite big in, which is actually the world's largest REIT, is American Tower Corporation. So that's our biggest holding in that space. And they actually sell so it's sort of a weird one where they'll lease the area, say, on the top of a building. They'll put a tower up, and then they'll lease the tower to telecommunications companies.
You're intertwining your telco and your real estate theme in one there. That's quite clever.
Yeah. And so years ago, what would happen is telcos would actually largely build their own towers, and then every now and again they'd share. And that's where American Tower Corp, if it's only got one telco on it, it's marginal at best and possibly even loss making on some of those towers. But then they add two, because their costs don't change, they've already built everything, they get significantly better margins. And once they add three or four, they get really good margins on these things. Yeah. And the thing that's popped up is 5G needs way more towers than 4G or 3G ever did. And so it's now, I think, whereas in the past some telcos used to go, well, I'll share some towers every now and again, but largely I want to have my own because I want to have the best network and be able to, you know, target people, or I don't want to share my network with other people.
Block it out. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Whereas the number of extra points people are going to need to have a good 5G service, I think will start meaning that becomes less of an issue for people. Just be about saying, well, yes, I could go and build my own, but it's going to cost me more. So whereas I can rent it for cheaper from these guys, and yes, I'm sharing with three other people, but that just means I can, I can get it for cheaper, and I've got to build so many of these anyway. So yeah, an area that we quite like in terms of I guess what I'm trying to get to there. It's a long way of saying is I think trying to find defensive stocks, defensive areas of your portfolio that aren't the traditional ones is going to be worthwhile for the next little while, just because of the numbers of uncertainties and number of structural changes we're facing.
Yep. Just there's a comment here. My wife and I are loving the returns from your growth fund lately, but feeling a little trepidation, a dip might be coming soon. Any calming words for us in that space?
Yeah, investing's a long, yeah. Look.
I think what you've been talking about today, just then in particular, where you've got the defensive allocation. So as many of our investors know, you know protecting on the downside's a core component of the way we think about things. But you've still got to get some market upside in there as well.
Yeah, that's right. I keep forgetting who it is. There's somebody who describes themselves as a fully invested bear. We're close to fully invested bear. We are concerned about a lot of things, but there has been so much stimulus, so much, this is a market that's driven by central banks and it's driven by government stimulus. And yep. It's hard to stand in the way of that. I spend every day trying to work out what can go wrong. And, if you spend too long on it, you end up at this point where you never do anything because you're always so worried that there's always things that can go wrong. I do think right now there are a lot of things that can go wrong, but the same token, there's a lot of things that can go right. And so for us, it's about trying to maintain enough of an exposure that you're not sort of just going to sit in, especially with cash yielding you nothing. You step out of the market and the market doesn't go down, and you get more stimulus and you get more company profits keep on growing and you start getting productivity gains sort of over the next few years as a number of the new technologies start ticking into place and the shift out of China and back to other countries. And next thing you've sat out of the market for, another 10, 15% and missed that upside and you just never get a chance to buy back in. So,
and that's another key part of it, I think, for, we obviously help people out with recommendations through our online portal, but it's, that time frame is the critical component. So it's about, whilst things don't look great now, and there's obviously things we're doing to inside the portfolios to help mitigate some of those risks. That's the long term view when it comes to investing in shares. It's the most important.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think we've used in the past. We've spoken. There's a quite a famous measure called the Shiller PE, which is the he looks at like some 10 years worth of earnings, and it's the whole idea is it's this very long-term sort of cyclical thing that gives you this nice, gives you a good indication about whether you should buy or sell. And, if you just said, I was only going to buy in when this Shiller PE was below its average, it's, 100-year average, is that you would have bought in after the 87 crash, and I think in 2008, and every other time you would have said, I need to be out of the market.
Yeah,
for a sort of 30, 40 years, you've been sitting there going, it's going to come back eventually, and everyone else will rue the day they invested and made all this money, And so
Fair enough. Wise words. All right. Very good. Look, thanks, mate. I think we're pretty much up on time there. It's been some great questions. Thanks again for your time and sharing the thoughts on the FANGs. I'll be always looking forward to seeing how they relate and obviously how they work through our portfolios as well. So once again, thanks again.
Thanks.
All good. All right, we'll roll across to our viewer question of the week. And so we'll throw it back to you. Which FANG stock or Microsoft, we'll throw Microsoft in there as well, of course, do you think is your best investment?
Yeah, that's right. Sneakily, it's FANG with an M instead of an N because we've replaced Netflix with Microsoft in it.
Well, I think Netflix is the minnow, isn't it? It feels like it may have run its race. But anyway, always interested to see and hear your thoughts. So feel free to drop those in to the YouTube chats there, and we can read through those and take it from there. Awesome. And thanks again to everyone, of course, who's watched in for another great episode. And to all of those that asked some terrific questions and comments as well, we always appreciate those. I hope you've taken away some great ideas. And if you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video now to give us some feedback. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nicholaswealth.com/content. To stay up to date on news from us, follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who'd get something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. So thanks again for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team, and we look forward to catching you at the next one.